sake, I delight in weaknesses, in insults, in hardships, in persecutions, in difficulties. For when I am weak, then I am strong. Scholars have long speculated on what exactly Paul meant about his thorn. Some think it was temporary blindness, like he had suffered when famously struck down on the road to Damascus. Did this blindness return from time to time? In contrast, many medieval theologians were persuaded that Paul's torment was stigmata, a mystical phenomenon in which a person so deeply identifies with the suffering of Jesus that he or she develops the wounds of crucifixion on hands and feet. Another theory is that Paul was referring to the constant persecution he suffered at the hands of Jewish and Roman authorities. Finally, some thought he might have meant the temptations of sin. In a more modern analysis in the Journal of Neurology, neurologist David Lansborough hypothesized that Paul's torment was most likely temporal lobe epilepsy, which would explain the ecstatic personal experiences such as being caught up to paradise, as he mentions in his letters, and seeing visions. This could also explain the flash of light he experienced on the road to Damascus, followed by temporary blindness, too. This condition would have progressed through his life to more generalized convulsions, Lansborough argues, and it could most certainly have seemed like a thorn in the flesh sent by Satan. Given the way he writes, we have to assume that most of Paul's followers in the early church knew full well the nature of his affliction. He must have talked about it openly many times and found it unnecessary here to describe it in any more detail. The real question is why he reminded them of this weakness. Was it to stimulate pity or guilt among his followers? Certainly not. His clear purpose was to show them that he, the great Paul, visionary and apostle of Christ, was flawed, mortal, and weak. But Paul goes further. He says that this is his source of strength. This is a man whose force of will and oratorical gifts, traditional leadership strengths, brought in many thousands of converts to a brand new religion and created the basis of its theology. Yet, he was claiming his true strength was his torment and, if Lansborough was correct, his physical deterioration. At first consideration, this seems like a leadership lesson worthy of through the looking glass, where up is down and backward is forward. For most of us, it sounds impossible and insane to advertise our decline to those we need to impress. Hey, everyone, I'm sick, suffering, and getting worse. Want to join my religion? That's pretty bad marketing. And advertising our own source of decline always seems bad for us, too, which is why people spend inordinate amounts of time and money trying to cover up the ravages of time. Botox, hair plugs, and invisible hearing aids are good business for a reason. In the lives of strivers, no one goes around bragging that they don't have good ideas anymore or that they lack the energy they once had. The fact that weakness and loss are bad might be the reason you picked up this book in the first place. Decline is loss. Loss is bad. Remediate it or hide it, but certainly don't talk about it. Right? Wrong. Paul was right. The secret to going from strength to strength is to recognize that your weakness, your loss, your decline, can be a gift to you and others. Human connection through weakness. I had a friend many years ago, a clinical psychologist with a booming practice in New England. At 45, he was at the top of his profession, which he adored. But he had a problem. Having suffered all his life with type 1 diabetes, he was now losing his sight. Not an uncommon malady for diabetics as they age. His initial reaction was total denial, and he insisted on continuing his life as he always had, including driving. He finally faced up to his impending blindness, averting potential tragedy, when his neighbors complained that he was running over their mailboxes. He struggled for a number of years, angry at God for giving him this cruel fate. But then one day he received a phone call from a woman who told him she was experiencing a mental health crisis and needed treatment but had reason not to divulge her identity. She was quite famous, it turned out, and desired anonymity, even with her therapist. She needed, and found, a blind psychologist. He helped the woman and went on to build a practice around well-known people who desired similar treatment. What my friend had to do was let go of his pride and become defenseless and his weakness. Only then could he prosper in a new way. This is the case made by Brené Brown in her best-selling book, Daring Greatly, How the Courage to be Vulnerable Transforms the Way We Live, Love, Parent, and Lead. Brown talks about making ourselves vulnerable to others if we really want to be happy and successful, that walling ourselves off hurts us. Another way to understand Brown's point is that, as we all know, defensiveness is a terrible quality and never helps us. The right goal is defenselessness. But the point I'm making pushes the case a little further. It is indeed important to take risks and be willing to fail, to dare greatly, as Brown likes to say. But the true master then uses the inevitable failures, including the declines that inevitably follow a life of success, as a deep source of human connection. I personally learned this quite by accident. I already told you that my college background was unorthodox and that I got my degree by distance learning at about the age of 30. I never really talked about this fact by the time I was an academic because all my colleagues had gone to fancy universities and, well, I was embarrassed. After a decade, I left university teaching to become the president of a think tank in Washington, D.C., a major step in my career into an extremely high-profile position that at times was at the center of political and policy controversies. My credibility affected the success of my entire institution, so I was extremely self-conscious about everything in my background, including my non-traditional undergraduate education. In a world where it seemed like everyone went to Harvard or Princeton, I was afraid someone would hold up my resume and say, "Hey, everybody, look at this hack." I needn't have worried, it turned out. A few years into my tenure at the think tank, there was an effort by Microsoft's Bill Gates and a few other philanthropists to create a bachelor's degree that would cost $10,000, a so-called 10K BA. The idea was lambasted by people all over higher education as a worthless idea because nothing like that could be any good, right? I was so enraged by this elitist attitude that I finally owned up to my own past and wrote about my $10,000 college experience in the New York Times, about how my education was perfectly good and how it gave me the opportunity to build my life and career. I braced myself for an onslaught of derision, maybe even criticism that would threaten my position. But it didn't happen. Instead, I got hundreds of notes and emails from people who went to school non-traditionally to build their lives. They told me that it was empowering to see someone like me who shared a story not of being the golden boy with elite opportunities, but of someone not welcome at traditional schools. I got to know and began to write about many of these people and their experiences. I became an open advocate for non-traditional education and a champion for the life entrepreneurs who pursue it. Here is what I learned from that experience. It was through my weakness, not my strength, that I was able to connect with people I never would have met otherwise. These were strivers, outsiders who were overlooked in the traditional ways, and they were my people. I never would have connected to any of them had I not shared my story with all its twists and turns. The lesson is that if you want to make a deep human connection with someone, your strengths and worldly successes won't cut it. You need your weaknesses for that. If I had gone to a fancy college, it might impress people, but it wouldn't establish a connection with most of them. Elite means not many have that distinction. And that distinction is hard to attain. Elite credentials don't make you relatable. They're a barrier to deep human connection. Let's go back to St. Paul for a moment to illustrate this. From our current perspective, it's pretty easy to see Paul as one of the great winners in history. As such, it's nearly impossible to imagine Paul as a man in decline. And yet that is almost certainly how he saw himself. Near the end of his life, Paul wrote letters from a prison cell to churches that seemed to be fragmenting. He felt abandoned by his friends. "Demas, because he loved this world, has deserted me and has gone to Thessalonica. Crescens has gone to Galatia and Titus to Dalmatia," he wrote to his disciple Timothy. "Alexander the metal worker did me a great deal of harm. At my first defense, no one came to my support, but everyone deserted me." His only hope appeared to be in the hereafter. "The Lord will rescue me from every evil attack and will bring me safely to his heavenly kingdom." Notwithstanding his faith, Paul must have seen his earthly work as a failure, destined to be forgotten. What we see today, at least 2 billion Christians, would have been unimaginable to him. No matter what your religious beliefs, there are two obvious lessons here. First, as I've been emphasizing over and over, It doesn't matter who you are. If you live long enough, you will see the decline of your fluid intelligence. Second, you never really know what kind of impact your work will have had. There's no telling. But there's a more important lesson than these. It was Paul's very sadness about worldly events, while maintaining his faith, that has attracted people for thousands of years. I started the chapter by noting he connected with people through his weakness, the thorn in his flesh. But it was his words of sadness and suffering at the end of his life that magnetized the Christian faith for the ages as one of authentic human experience, a faith that understands the pain in ordinary lives and the human reaction to it. This was not the norm in Paul's time. His philosophical contemporaries admired and followed the Stoics, who sought to banish emotional expressions of suffering from their communication. A wise person, the Stoics taught, is strong and disciplined enough to see that anger and grief are senseless and destructive. Suffering should be borne, well, stoically. In contrast, Paul wrote to the Corinthian church, "Out of great distress and anguish of heart and with many tears." Paul was basically an anti-Stoic. So ask yourself, which type of person do you want to be? One who declines with seeming indifference while suffering privately? Or one who, like Paul, acknowledges loss openly and yet maintains faith, believes in the power of love, and continues to serve others? Your decline, as painful as it is, should be experienced and shared. The benefits of weakness, pain, and loss. While it goes against many of our instincts, the evidence is overwhelming that defenselessness enhances life success. Studies show, for example, that when nurses are vulnerable with patients about their own lives, they are more absorbed in their work, and patients become more courageous and engaged in their care, and thus have better outcomes. Organizational leaders are happier and perceived as more effective by their subordinates when they are vulnerable and human. Conversely, people who are defensive or aloof reduce trust among those they lead, are unhappier, and less effective as a result. Vulnerability can be about little things or intensely painful personal experiences. In 2019, for example, the comedian Stephen Colbert elicited an enormous amount of public admiration when he was asked in an interview by CNN's Anderson Cooper about a plane crash that killed Colbert's father and two of his brothers when he was 10 years old. Cooper had heard Colbert say previously that he had learned to love the thing that I most wish had not happened. He asked Colbert to clarify this extraordinary statement. "It's a gift to exist, and with existence comes suffering," replied Colbert. "I don't want it to have happened, but if you are grateful for your life, then you have to be grateful for all of it. You can't pick and choose what you're grateful for." Beyond simply demonstrating incredible vulnerability, Colbert is saying that he found strength in his tragedy. The psychiatrist Viktor Frankl said much the same thing in his famous book, Man's Search for Meaning, which chronicled in intimate detail his time imprisoned by the Nazis in the Auschwitz concentration camp. "When a man finds that it is his destiny to suffer, he will have to accept his suffering as his task, his single and unique task. He will have to acknowledge the fact that even in suffering, he is unique and alone in the universe. No one can relieve him of his suffering or suffer in his place. His unique opportunity lies in the way in which he bears his burden." Frankl felt that people could find the meaning of their lives and personal growth in all kinds of suffering. Colbert's and Frankl's ideas are at odds with the way we typically see suffering and weakness today, as something to be avoided and certainly not shared. They are personal, embarrassing, or too painful to recount. Further, we have a tendency to assume that traumatic events, from accidents to illnesses to all kinds of personal loss, can only provoke pain and lingering problems, especially if we talk about them with others. However, this isn't generally the case. The key, as Colbert and Frankl suggest, is finding meaning in the suffering and sharing that meaning. I have seen this remarkable transformation, and I bet you have too. A dear friend of mine was told he would not survive more than a year after a late-stage cancer diagnosis. This was an anxious guy by nature, always stressed about life's details, and this prognosis might logically have sunk him further into his natural funk. Just the opposite happened. He realized that he had been missing his own true life, and he decided that, confronted with limited time, he wasn't going to miss any more of it. He vowed to remember that every day might be his last, to live whatever life he had left simply as he truly was, focused on what he truly loved, and to share this truth with others. By some miracle, my friend survived a year, then another, and then 2 decades more. His doctor said the cancer would ultimately be back at some point. The wolf is always at the door with these things, which, paradoxically perhaps, kept him from going back to his old ways of thinking. He was happy and grateful for waking up from his slumber decades ago and continued to live as if he were enjoying his last few months. When he died last year, the wolf finally got in. He was surrounded by his beloved family and at peace. He had blessed all of us with his gift decades. This flies in the face of a good deal of established wisdom, which has its tangled roots in Freudian psychology. Sigmund Freud believed that trauma from pain and loss is always harmful to a person, and relief requires getting beyond trauma's often hidden mal-effects. Of course, we can find many cases of deleterious trauma from among sufferers of abuse and PTSD, but this is not the norm. Emerging research shows clearly that most people are resilient, even more that they grow from losses and negative events. Negative emotions make us more effective in our day-to-day activities. In an influential 2009 article in the journal Psychological Review, the evolutionary psychologists Paul W. Andrews and J. Anderson Thompson argue that sadness has persisted in the face of evolution because it brings cognitive benefits. There is evidence that it makes us better at assessing reality in social situations because we are less likely to flatter ourselves or gloss over negative truths. Sadness can even make us more productive at work by enhancing focus and helping us learn from mistakes. This is how failure, via resulting negative emotions, can help lead to later success. Psychologists have found that many of the most meaningful experiences in life are quite painful. In one 2018 study, for example, two psychologists at Western Illinois University asked a large group of college students to report the positive and negative emotions, as well as the meaningfulness they associated with their education and with their relationships. The students reported that these things gave them tremendous meaning, but that the cost was high. As the researchers summarized their findings, meaning involves negative affect and worry about loss. Finally, exposure to negative emotions makes us stronger for when there is a true crisis. Research shows that stress inoculation training, in which people learn to cope with anger, fear, and anxiety by being exposed to stimuli that cause these feelings, is effective in creating emotional resilience. It is easy to imagine that attempts to eliminate pain and weakness from daily life could lead to a sort of emotional allergy. That when hard times come and someone feels grief or fear that is impossible to ignore, that person will not have the tools to face these feelings. Attaining greatness in weakness. He is ready to end his life. Only moral rectitude keeps him back. So wrote a close friend of the great composer Ludwig van Beethoven, whose life had become a hero's journey gone wrong. Beethoven was named after his grandfather, who lived from 1712 to 1773 and was generally considered the preeminent musician in the city of Bonn. His grandson showed the same prodigious talents from an early age. As a young man working in Vienna, Beethoven was often thought of as the artistic heir to the recently deceased Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart. He studied with the world-famous Joseph Haydn, as well as musical masters Antonio Salieri and Johann Albrechtsberger. It was legitimate to believe that Beethoven would be the greatest composer of his time and one of the greatest pianists to boot. Ambitious and hardworking, by his late 20s, he was already famous. For some years, however, he had been troubled by a strange buzzing and ringing in his ears. "For the last 3 years, my hearing has grown steadily weaker," Beethoven wrote to his doctor in 1801 when he was 30. "In the theater, I have to get very close to the orchestra to understand the performers, and from a distance, I do not hear the high notes of the instruments and the singers' voices." He held out hope that his hearing problem could be remediated, but that hope was fading by the year as it became clear to him and those around him that there was no hope of remission. Beethoven was going deaf. What fate could be crueler than this? A pianist and composer can work without sight or use of his legs, but deaf? No chance. The greatest potential performance and compositional career in a generation was disappearing before his eyes, and while still at the height of his fluid intelligence. It was like David striding out to battle with Goliath and getting killed in the first minute. So Beethoven raged. For a long time, after he could barely hear, he insisted on performing on the piano with worse and worse results. He would bang the keys so hard that he ruined pianos. In forte passages, the poor deaf man pounded on the keys until the strings jangled, wrote his friend and fellow composer Ludwig Spohr. I was deeply saddened at so hard a fate. Sounds sort of familiar, doesn't it? Have you seen someone in decline raging against it, unwilling to face the fact that his or her faculties were declining? Have you seen the equivalent of him or her wrecking pianos to the pity of those listening? This sounds like a sad ending for Beethoven, but it turns out it isn't the end of the story. He finally gave up performing as his deafness progressed, but found ingenious ways to keep composing. He would gauge the timbre of the notes on the piano by putting a pencil in his mouth and touching it to the soundboard while he played. When his hearing was partial, he avoided using notes with the frequencies out of the range of his hearing. In 2011, three scientists in Holland published an analysis in the British Medical Journal showing that high notes, above 1568 hertz, made up 80% of Beethoven's string quartets written in his 20s, but dropped to less than 20% in his 40s. In the last decade of Beethoven's life, he died at 56, his deafness was complete, so his compositions were only in his imagination. That meant the end of his compositional career, right? Wrong. During that period, Beethoven wrote the music that would define his unique style, change music permanently, and give him a legacy as one of the greatest composers of all time. Entirely deaf, Beethoven wrote his best string quartets, with more high notes than in works from the previous decade. His magisterial Missa Solemnis, and his greatest triumph of all, the Ninth Symphony. He insisted on conducting the latter piece's premiere in Vienna, although there was a second conductor standing behind Beethoven, whom the orchestra was actually following. After the performance, unaware of the standing ovation his masterpiece was receiving, Beethoven had to be physically turned around by one of the musicians to see the audience that was cheering for perhaps the greatest orchestral piece ever written. Being aware of Beethoven's deafness, they threw their hats and scarves in the air to make sure he could see their enthusiasm. It seems counterintuitive, to say the least, that Beethoven became more original and brilliant as a composer in inverse proportion to his ability to hear his own and others' music. But maybe it isn't so surprising. As his hearing deteriorated, he was less influenced by the prevailing compositional fashions and more by the music forming inside his own head. His early work is pleasantly reminiscent of his instructor Joseph Haydn's music. Beethoven's later work became so original that he was, and is, regarded as the father of music's romantic period. He opened up a new world in music, said French romantic master Hector Berlioz, who idolized the deaf composer. Beethoven is not human. It would be naive to think that Beethoven fully appreciated the artistic freedom his deafness granted him. I can imagine he went to his grave regretting his loss of hearing because it cost him his beloved career as a fine pianist. He did not know the extent to which his radical new compositional style, heard only by others, would define him as truly great for hundreds of years after his death. Maybe he had a clue, however. It is significant that his Ninth Symphony closes triumphantly as the chorus sings lines from Friedrich Schiller's poem, Ode to Joy. Joy, a spark of fire from heaven, drunk with fire we dare to enter, Holy One, inside your shrine. You can finally relax. To see weakness as purely negative is a mistake. Weakness befalls us all, and in many ways. It has its discomforts, to be sure, and entails loss. But it is also an opportunity to connect more deeply with others, to see the sacredness in suffering, even to find new areas of growth and success. Stop hiding it, and don't resist it. Doing so has another benefit for strivers, maybe the most important one of all. You can finally relax a little. When you are honest and humble about your weaknesses, you will be more comfortable in your own skin. When you use your weaknesses to connect with others, love in your life will grow. And finally, Finally, you will be able to relax without worrying about being exposed as less than people think you are. To share your weakness without caring what others think is a kind of superpower. What I'm recommending here is going to be hard for some listeners, though. I know you've learned your whole life to do the opposite, show strength. Sharing weakness is hard because it is the ultimate act of subversion against your special, objectified self. You won't go down without a fight. If you are reluctant to embrace your weaknesses, start by imagining the peace in your heart from no longer pretending that you are not weak. Visualize others drawn to you as a person of authenticity, defenseless and unafraid. See how they relax around you and confide in you. See how it lifts their spirits to be around a person of your considerable accomplishment who is unafraid to say, "I once was better at this than I am." Imagine people who are happier and less afraid because of you. Feel the relaxation in your mind and body that comes from being truly yourself, without hiding anything, and without caring about the results. See yourself relaxing in your humility, being yourself, and thus ready to jump to the second curve. But you still do have to jump. And as people remind me all the time, that means definitively leaving what is known and comfortable and striking out in a new direction in life. It means a big life transition. And as we all know, transitions can be hard. So that's where we need to turn our attention next, making the jump. Chapter 9, Cast into the Falling Tide. When I was a kid, I was crazy about fishing. No one in my family fished. I just took it up on my own. With money I earned on my paper route, I bought rod, reel, tackle, and books on fishing. Growing up in Seattle, I often fished in Puget Sound, and in the summers, off the rocks in the ocean in a place called Lincoln City on the rugged Oregon coast. Ocean fishing is fun, but really different from fishing in a lake. You don't just throw in your line and expect to catch something. I learned this the first time I tried at about age 11. For a couple of hours, I stood casting into the water off the rocks without a single bite. After a while, along came a wizened old fisherman from the area who asked me how it was going. "Lousy," I told him. "Nothing's biting." "That's because you're doing it wrong," he told me. "You have to wait for the falling tide when the tide is going out fast." "It seems kind of counterintuitive," he explained, "because you see the water rushing out and assume the fish would be going out to sea as well. However, this is when the plankton and bait fish are all stirred up, making the game fish crazy and looking to bite everything." Together, we watched and waited for about 45 minutes until the tide was moving out fast. At that point, the old man said, "Let's fish." We cast out and sure enough, within seconds, started pulling in fish, one after another. We did it for about half an hour. What fun! Afterward, relaxing on the rocks, the old man lit a cigarette and began to wax philosophical. "Kid, there's only one mistake you can make during a falling tide," he said. "What's that?" I asked. "Not having your line in the water." I've remembered that day many times while writing this book. There is a falling tide to life, the transition from fluid to crystallized intelligence. This is an intensely productive and fertile period. It's when you jump from one curve to the other, when you face your success addiction, when you chip away the inessential parts of your life, when you ponder your death, when you build your relationships, when you start your vanaprastha. Unfortunately, the falling tide of your life is also incredibly scary and difficult. It may even feel like some sort of midlife crisis. It might feel like everything you've worked for is rushing away. Seeing it as tragedy can be easier than seeing it as opportunity. In this last lesson, we will learn how to cast into the falling tide, to get started on your transition with energy and confidence. Indeed, your biggest life transition doesn't have to be a crisis or a period of loss, but rather can be an exciting adventure full of opportunities you never knew existed. Liminality. There's nothing new about hard, scary midlife transitions. In his 14th century Divine Comedy, Dante Alighieri nicely sums up a fear many of us have had. "Midway upon the journey of our life, I found myself within a forest dark, for the straightforward pathway had been lost." Psychologists have a special word for uncomfortable life transitions: liminality. It means the time between work roles, organizations, career paths, and relationship stages. The author Bruce Feiler wrote a popular book in 2020 on liminality called Life is in the Transitions: Mastering Change at Any Age. He told me that he became interested in the topic after a cancer diagnosis left him in debilitating treatment and facing the real possibility of death in his 40s with young kids at home. It was a period he called a life quake, changing his outlook on nearly everything, but ultimately enriching his understanding and appreciation of his life and work. In his book, he interviews hundreds of people about their transitions, finding that a significant change in life occurs, on average, every 18 months, and that life quakes like his, or those that involve voluntary or involuntary career changes, happen very regularly. Most are involuntary, and thus unwelcome at the time, but nothing is more predictable than change. Most wisdom traditions have long taught this. The Stoic philosopher Marcus Aurelius said that the universe is transformation, life is opinion. The Buddha spoke very frequently about the impermanence, in Sanskrit, anitya, of everything. Impermanent truly are conditioned things, having the nature of arising and passing away, he taught. It struck him as the greatest irony that the central characteristic of the universe, change, is the thing with which we are most uncomfortable. He taught that to be at peace, we must accept the impermanence of life and existence. There are many meditations on impermanence, and they almost all take the same basic form of calmly noticing and accepting the change that surrounds you at every second. For example, without judgment, notice the constant changes in your thoughts and perceptions as your mind wanders from topic to topic. Feel your breathing and perhaps your pulse, and visualize the changes you cannot feel, such as the cells that are dividing and dying, the growth of your hair and fingernails. Consider the changes occurring in the world you can't see but you know are occurring. People accomplishing things, being born and dying, the earth moving around the sun, and the moon around the earth. Impermanence is simply the state of nature. As strange as it seems, even collective transitions on the scale of the slow, rolling, life-changing coronavirus pandemic are normal and regular, happening about once a decade. If you're my age, you remember the collapse of the Soviet Union, which radically shifted geopolitics. A decade later, you saw the 9/11 terrorist attacks that changed much about how we see the world. A few years after that was the financial crisis and deep recession that altered our economy and financial system. A decade later, there was COVID-19. In the coming decade, there will almost certainly be an unwelcome cataclysmic event. We just don't know what it is yet. And it will undoubtedly catch us by surprise because we will still be thinking about the pandemic and the financial crisis. As difficult as these are, the transitions in our private lives are harder. Liminality between the phases of adult life is especially uncomfortable because one doesn't quite know oneself anymore. As one management scholar puts it, employees who do not successfully traverse this period experience ongoing identity instability. They are cognitively and emotionally consumed by the loss, stagnating in their inability to let go of the old self and/or to embrace the new and changed work self. A college professor in career transition describes liminality like this: "For almost 3 years now, I've been living through the stories I tell about being and not being there. Stories that always leave me with this sense of incompleteness. I try to bridge the gap between the two places, to eradicate the distance, to stand still. Standing still, trying to find my center. Me, the decentered one, to find my balance with one foot on one boat and the other on another." I bet that sounds familiar to a lot of listeners. It does to me, too. After a decade as president of a think tank, managing a large workforce of scholars at the vortex of the Washington, D.C. policy battles, I stepped away voluntarily in the summer of 2019, an almost unheard-of move in my business. I walked away from the people and the job I knew and loved, and the excitement of being near the action of politics and policymaking. Why? Because I did the research in this book and committed to myself to following the implications. How can I give you advice if I don't take it myself? This was all of my own volition, but that was scant comfort. For 2 years, complicated by the pandemic, of course, my wife and I were disoriented and lonely. Sometimes I woke up in the morning and mentally prepared for a day at the think tank before remembering that that was the past and that I was in Massachusetts, not Maryland. Weirdly, I noticed that my signature seemed to have changed, as if I were trying to impersonate someone else. Liminality is uncomfortable, as all transitions are difficult. But here's the good news. Even unwelcome transitions are usually seen differently in retrospect than they are in real time. Indeed, Filer finds that 90% of the time, people ultimately report that their transition was a success insofar as they made it through in one piece with no permanent setbacks. Even better, research shows that we tend to see important past events, even undesirable ones at the time, as net positives over time. This is in part because unpleasant feelings fade more than pleasant feelings do, a phenomenon known as fading affect bias. This may sound like a cognitive error, but it really isn't. Almost every transition, even the most difficult one, bears some positive fruit. We usually see and treasure it in the long run. For example, one of my sons is in the military. His boot camp was absolutely brutal, and a day after it finished, he told me he'd never voluntarily do anything like that again. Today, he talks about the experience, which earned him the title U.S. Marine, with amusement, relish, and pride. In fact, it is the difficult, painful transitions that can yield the greatest understanding of purpose in our lives. Research on how people derive meaning has uncovered that we actually need periods of pain and struggle that make us temporarily unhappy. To quote one study from 2013 that surveyed a national random sample of 397 adults, worry, stress, and anxiety were linked to higher meaningfulness, but lower happiness. In his book, Meanings of Life, psychologist Roy Baumeister argues that when you find meaning, life seems more stable. Perhaps paradoxically, suffering during transitions can create the meaning in life that imposes a sense of stability over subsequent transitions. This is one of the great consolations of aging and seeing a lot of change. Even more, painful periods can stimulate intense expressive productivity. Remember the falling tide? That's when the fish bite. There's a big scholarly literature on the high correlation between creative genius and mental suffering, which Sigmund Freud termed the problem of the creative artist. But you don't have to be Sylvia Plath or Vincent van Gogh to see a small version of it in your own life, as I have noticed it in mine. My comfort in exploring and expressing new ideas appears inversely proportional to my sense of stability. Among other things, this book is the fruit of my transition. Man was made for conflict, not for rest, Ralph Waldo Emerson wrote. Inaction is his power. Not in his goals, but in his transitions, man is great. I believe this is true, but it's easy to forget. Many mornings upon waking, my first thoughts are about my old work and friendships in Washington. I rub the sleep from my eyes, get up, and cast my line into the falling tide of the new day. Does it have to be a crisis? When we hear about big changes in midlife, we often assume they are a crisis. And indeed, the midlife crisis has an almost mythic stature to it, especially since the 1970s, when the writer Gail Sheehy published her mega best-selling book, Passages, Predictable Crises of Adult Life, which sold 5 million copies and captured the imagination of a whole generation. Using 115 in-depth interviews with men and women, Sheehy argued that people naturally go into a midlife crisis at about age 40, when they question the validity of their plans and goals. What she was finding without knowing it was the anxiety people feel when their fluid intelligence is starting to decline. She, however, thought people were simply anxious about becoming old. If age 40 doesn't sound old to you, remember that the average life expectancy was about 70 back then, and people had kids so early that 40 was when one's children were starting to leave home. Her most famous case study was that of John DeLorean, the Wunderkind GM executive, who in 1969 had a great awakening. It started when he visited the retired former president of General Motors. Instead of a contented, retired king of industry, he found a hollow shell of a man, sad and lonely. His life seemed purposeless and irrelevant. All he wanted to do was reminisce about the good old days when he ran the company. John saw his own future in the man and was badly shaken. "Why are you doing all this?" he asked himself afterward. "You're just like one of the machines. Suddenly you'll get obsolete and worn out and they'll scrap you. Does that make sense?" DeLorean reacted by divorcing his wife of 15 years and marrying a 20-year-old, divorcing her 3 years later to marry someone even younger. Meanwhile, he lost 40 pounds, dyed his hair, got plastic surgery on his face, started writing a novel about nuclear war, and talked publicly about neo-religious metamorphosis. Despite all this, DeLorean comes off pretty well in Sheehy's book. But his story ended badly the following decade. He started his own eponymous car company, DeLorean Motor Company, today remembered for the car featured in the hit film Back to the Future. They were terribly made and very slow, promptly leading him to the edge of bankruptcy. In a last-ditch effort to raise the cash needed to keep his empire from crashing down, he turned to the drug business. In 1982, at age 57, he was busted after attempting to sell 59 pounds of cocaine to a federal agent. Broken and humiliated, he became a lame national punchline. How can you tell a DeLorean has been on your street? The white lines are missing. Ha, ha. And after all that, his young wife divorced him. And you think you're having a bad midlife transition? All this fed the conventional belief that midlife transitions were negative and maybe even a physical inevitability. As the New York Times explained in 1971, a man in midlife crisis does not even know that something is happening inside his body, a physical change that is affecting his emotions. Sheehy noted that women experienced the midlife crisis as well as men, however. She herself wrote that as she entered middle age, some intruder shook me by the psyche and shouted, "Take stock! Half your life has been spent!" She noted that this often coincides with early signs of menopause, leading some to wonder whether the crisis was a biological phenomenon, even in men. Later research showed that while transitions are real and inevitable, a crisis is not. The term midlife crisis was actually coined by the psychiatrist Elliot Jacques in the early 1960s. Ironically, he didn't love his own theory. According to an interview with Jacques' widow, the midlife crisis was a tiny little early piece of work that he did and something Jacques didn't want to talk about after 20 or 30 years. Apparently, he became unconvinced that the crisis was ubiquitous, and later research supported his skepticism. In 1995, scholars at the University of Wisconsin published Midlife in the United States, a National Longitudinal Study of Health and Well-Being. Their conclusion? Most people don't have a crisis, according to psychologist Margie Lachman, one of the project's leaders. That is, most people don't have a major negative emotional event, even if they change jobs and careers. The bottom line is that no one is doomed to turn into John DeLorean because of some temporary insanity at midlife. One thing we do know, however, is that people naturally tend to experience a big transition in the middle of adult life. We sense the decline in our fluid intelligence and that we need a change. If we know there's a crystallized intelligence curve behind it and are making a reset, we enter liminality. It can be uncomfortable and scary, but it doesn't mean you will have a meltdown. A major inflection in your life does not mean you will abandon your spouse or buy a red sports car. On the contrary, your professional reset can bring you closer to your family and friends and inspire others. There are famous examples of this from history. In 458 BC, Lucius Quinctius Cincinnatus was the dictator of Rome when the city was under siege. He led Rome to victory, remained in power long enough to see the return of stability, and then abruptly resigned. He retired to his small farm where he worked and lived humbly with his family. Had he remained a dictator in Rome after his victory, he would probably today be a historical footnote. A man who governed as a dictator for a few years, gradually became ineffective and unpopular, held on as long as possible, and was assassinated. We certainly wouldn't have named a city in Ohio after him. He's remembered as great because he wasn't afraid to walk away. I have a couple of less famous examples that inspire me. My late father once told me about a minor mystery from his childhood. His father, born in Denver in 1893, was a Methodist minister and principal of a school on the Navajo Indian Reservation in New Mexico, where my father was born. He was beloved and successful in his job. There were no apparent problems. But one day in 1942, my grandfather, then 49, abruptly announced that they would be moving. They packed up the car and headed to Chicago. He didn't lose his job, no push. Nor did he have a job waiting, no pull either. He just had an overwhelming desire for change. This was unusual at the time, before a job was commonly seen as a means of self-expression. A breadwinner didn't just quit his job. It was especially unusual in the middle of World War II, when the American economy was under enormous strain. They arrived in suburban Chicago, and my grandfather showed up at the doorstep of his alma mater, Wheaton College. He asked for work. He did various administrative tasks, did them well, and over the next decade rose to the position of dean of students in addition to teaching theology. He was awarded an honorary doctorate by the college and is still remembered fondly today by elderly alumni. This was a major reset, but hardly a midlife crisis. The solidest of solid citizens, my grandfather never left my grandmother, never wavered in his faith, and never, ever bought a sports car. He was basically the anti-DeLorean. He simply went in search of a new adventure in which he could earn his success and serve others. And not coincidentally, it was a career that amply rewarded his crystallized intelligence. My dad never forgot his father's model of a virtuous career reset. Around the age of 40, he himself got the itch. After college and a master's degree, he had taken a dream job teaching mathematics at his own beloved alma mater. But as the years passed, my dad found he was falling behind. The younger faculty with PhDs were getting promotions and raises. He felt he was becoming a dinosaur. He thought about it for a year or so and decided to start a PhD in biostatistics, a new field for him. After 4 years of hard work, he published his dissertation, an analog of multiple R-square for uncensored survival data with covariates. It did not sell as well as Gail Sheehy's book. I was 14 when my dad got his PhD. He died fairly young, mid-60s, and it wasn't a happy ending. The way I choose to remember my dad is right after his career reset, proud and joyful. Here's my point. A career reset does not have to result in a midlife crisis. The trick is to be like my grandfather and father, not like John DeLorean. Modern elders. In the times of my grandfather and father, a life reset was basically a roll-your-own proposition. No one helped anyone through liminality. Today, however, there are resources to help you. A good example is the Modern Elder Academy, started by Chip Conley. Chip himself is a career and life reset story worthy of a Hollywood biopic. Worldly success came early in life. At 27, he founded Joie de Vivre Hospitality, a California-based hotel and restaurant company that he ran for more than two decades. By his late 40s, however, he was burned out and restless, despite the worldly success it had brought him. "I didn't want to be doing it anymore," he told me. "I felt like I was in a prison." This was compounded by a number of personal traumas, including the suicides of five close friends and a near-death experience of his own. Chip sold his company with no plans for what to do next and wound up consulting to the startup Airbnb, the online marketplace for temporary lodging. He thought the 20-something founders had engaged him for his experience in the hospitality industry, but found that wasn't where his real value lay. Instead, he found himself dispensing wisdom more than knowledge, advice about life and leadership. "You are our modern elder," they told him. At first, he took umbrage at this title. He was at least two decades their senior, but wasn't old. In California, though, youth is everything. Little by little, however, he settled into this role and came to love the fact that sharing what he had learned in life was creating significant value. He loved it so much, in fact, that he wanted to create this kind of opportunity for others. He knew that there were countless people his age in the phase of liminality, cognizant of the decrease in their fluid intelligence, but only dimly aware of their growing crystallized intelligence. He wanted to define the modern elder role. And thus, in 2018, his Modern Elder Academy, MEA, was born. For a week at a time, Conley brings groups of 14 to 18 to his small Oceanside campus in Baja, California. With an average age of 53, 800 participants to date have come from many walks of life, from steelworkers to doctors to retiring CEOs. What they have in common is a desire to reset their lives in a productive, joyful way in which they can serve others with their ideas and experience. There are four learning steps in becoming a modern elder. Evolve from a fixed to a growth mindset, learn openness to new things, collaborate with teams, and counsel others. To give a flavor of the MEA program, here are questions each participant must be able to answer by the time they finish. Chip calls this the next charter of your life, and it features a number of similarities to lessons we have learned in previous chapters. In your next phase of life, what activities will you keep? What activities will you evolve and do differently? What activities will you let go of? What new activities will you learn? And to start, what will you commit to doing in the next week to evolve into the new you? What will you commit to doing in the next month? What will you commit to doing within 6 months? In a year, what will be the first fruits to appear as a result of your commitments? The first thing Chip tells participants, and it's worth reminding you and me, is that a reset at, say, 50 is hardly late in life. Think about it this way. Your adult life starts at about age 20. If you have decent health, age 50 is most likely less than halfway through your adult life. As I publish this book, I am 57 years old. The actuarial tables tell me that given my lifestyle and current health, but not counting the early death of my parents, I have a 50-50 chance of living 40 more years, and a lot of that will be working years. The point? I'm crazy if I think it's too late to reset. Four lessons for a good liminality. Just as I was finishing up this book, I got an email from someone I had never met, which summed up the Striver's Curse as well as anything I've ever read. I now find myself on the wrong side of 50, with a deep, profound sense of regret, having spent the past 30 years of my life chasing one goal, work success. And while I've attained that goal, the personal cost has been extraordinarily high. The past 30 years can never be recovered. The relationships and other life events missed out on can never be experienced. He told me he's ready for a major change in his career and life. However, I have few skills to make a major career change. Those that aren't work-related atrophied long ago. Most days, I feel I should quit my fancy, important finance job immediately and start over, focusing on more meaningful and less time-sucking work and relationships, volunteering, travel, giving my time to others, listening to the birds chirp, planting some flowers. But that also feels like a radical knee-jerk path, one which I would have no skills to navigate anyway. One solid piece of advice is for him to spend a week in Baja, California with Chip Conley, or attend any formal program popping up around the world to help people with their professional reset, for that matter. That's not practical for a lot of people, however. So here are some concrete lessons to get started, based on the best research and the most successful strategies I have seen. Lesson 1. Identify your marshmallow. Maybe find your marshmallow sounds like some groovy 60s code language for dropping acid or joining a commune, but you already know that's not my advice. It's actually just a nod to a classic social science experiment. In 1972, the Stanford University social psychologist Walter Mischel undertook a psychology experiment involving preschool kids and a bag of marshmallows. He would sit across the table from each child, take out a marshmallow, and ask, "Do you want it?" Obviously, they did. He told them it was theirs, but there was a catch. He was going to leave the room for 15 minutes. The child could eat the marshmallow while he was gone if he or she wanted. But when the researcher came back in, if the first marshmallow was still there, the child would get a second one. Mischel found that a majority of the kids couldn't wait and gobbled up the marshmallow when he left the room. He followed up on the children in the study and found that those who were able to delay their gratification found greater success as they grew up. They were healthier, happier, earned more, and scored higher on their SATs than the kids who had eaten the marshmallow. In the years that followed, other researchers pointed out that Michelle's results were about far more than just willpower. They also involved the child's family background, socioeconomic circumstances, and other factors. But the implication remained. Good things come to those who wait, and work, and sacrifice, and maybe even suffer. The question for you is not whether you could have passed Michelle's marshmallow test. You wouldn't be bothering with this book if you couldn't, because you wouldn't have had enough success to be suffering right now. The question, at this moment of reset, is, what exactly is the next marshmallow? Do you know what you want as you start making new sacrifices? If you're scratching your head, don't despair. That's what the next three lessons are for. Lesson two, the work you do has to be the reward. One of the biggest mistakes people make in their careers is to treat work primarily as a means to an end. Maybe this is what you have done throughout your career up to this point. If so, that's a mistake, and it's time to stop. Whether that end is money, power, or prestige, the instrumentalization of work leads to unhappiness. This is just one example of a broader truth, that waiting for a destination to be happy is an error. In his 1841 essay, Self-Reliance, Ralph Waldo Emerson wrote, "At home I dream that at Naples, at Rome, I can be intoxicated with beauty and lose my sadness. I pack my trunk, embrace my friends, embark on the sea, and at last wake up in Naples, and there beside me is the stern fact, the sad self, unrelenting, identical, that I fled from." You know perfectly well that when your career is just a means to an end, the payoff, even if you get it, will be unsatisfying because you will already be looking for the next payoff. If you made that mistake before, what's done is done. But don't make that mistake again. Your reset won't give you the joy and fulfillment every day, of course. Some days it will feel pretty unsatisfying like anything else in life. But with the right goals, earning your success, and serving others, you can make the rest of your career itself your reward. Lesson three, do the most interesting thing you can. Over the years, I've endured many graduation ceremonies and observed that there are two basic types of speeches from commencement speakers. The first can be summarized as, go find your purpose. The second is, find work you love and you'll never work a day in your life. Which one is better advice? Not just for graduates, but for all of us. A group of German and American scholars sought to answer this question in 2017. They created what they called the Work Passion Pursuit Questionnaire, comparing the job satisfaction of people whose primary work goal was enjoyment with those whose primary work goal was finding meaning in their work. Across 1,357 people in their sample, the researchers found that enjoyment seekers had less passion for their work and changed jobs more frequently than meaning seekers. This is just an example of the age-old debate between two kinds of happiness that scholars refer to as hedonia and eudaimonia. Hedonia is about feeling good. Eudaimonia is about living a purpose-filled life. In truth, we need both. Hedonia without eudaimonia devolves into empty pleasure. Eudaimonia without hedonia can become dry. In the quest for the professional marshmallow, I think we should seek work that is a balance of enjoyable and meaningful. At the nexus of enjoyable and meaningful is interesting. Interest is considered by many neuroscientists to be a positive primary emotion processed in the limbic system of the brain. Something that truly interests you is intensely pleasurable. It also must have meaning in order to hold your interest. Thus, is this work deeply interesting to me is a helpful litmus test of whether a new activity is your new marshmallow. Lesson four. A career change doesn't have to be a straight line. We live in a culture that worships success, so much so that many of us are success addicts. Vast fortunes have accrued to tech startup founders in their 20s, and those founders come with a certain mythology. Whether it's true or not, the entrepreneur is often depicted as having a single abiding passion for which he or she is willing to pay any personal price. Their enormous worldly rewards are portrayed as the ultimate marshmallow. But this model doesn't describe how many, perhaps most, happy, fulfilled people have survived and thrived. Scholars at the University of Southern California have studied career patterns and come up with four broad categories. The first are linear careers, which climb steadily upward, with everything building on everything else. The concept of the corporate ladder is a very linear one. This is also the model of the billionaire entrepreneur. But it isn't the only career model. There are three others. Steady-state careers involve staying at one job, growing in expertise. Transitory careers are ones in which people jump from job to job or even field to field, looking for new challenges. Spiral careers, the last category, are more like a series of mini-careers. People spend many years developing in a profession, then shift fields, seeking not just novelty, but work that builds on the skills of their previous mini-careers. So, which one is best? Earlier in life, you might have had a super linear career, and that's okay. But most likely, as you now move to the second curve, a spiral pattern will be more appropriate. That means thinking more about what you really want now and less about what you wanted in the past, lowering your expectations about monetary compensation, and worrying less about whether it will look to someone else like a step down in prestige or not using your past experience and skills in the most obvious way. In other words, you might just go from running a hedge fund to teaching middle school history. And that's great. Jump. Years ago, I was on a family vacation in which we were circumnavigating the Big Island of Hawaii on bikes, interspersed with sightseeing and various adventures. One afternoon, we kayaked with a group of families to a rocky 30-foot cliff called the End of the World, from which a gang of teenagers was jumping into the surf below. One of the adults in my group said, "Anybody up for that?" Everyone else shook their heads no, so I volunteered. Looking down from the top of the volcanic cliff, it seemed like a mile to the water. My head started spinning, and I started thinking, "This is crazy. This is crazy. This is crazy." I glanced hesitantly at a kid standing next to me who was obviously a veteran of the jump. He grinned and said, "Don't think, dude. Just jump." So I did. Moments later, I hit the water. Yes, it hurt. And it was several seconds before I popped back up to the surface. The moment my head emerged, I had the sensation of being reborn. In Tibetan Buddhism, there's a concept called bardo, which is a state of existence between death and rebirth. In the Tibetan Book of Living and Dying, Buddhist monk Sogyal Rinpoche describes bardo as being like a moment when you step toward the edge of a precipice. You know you have to jump to be free, but it's scary. But then you jump. There's a brief transition. You are born anew. When I left my job as president of the think tank, it felt a little bit like facing death. It was the end of a whole style of life, set of experiences, and I knew full well relationships. Many listeners to this book know exactly what I mean here. Perhaps you don't love your work, especially if you're past your prime and tormented. Perhaps it's like a tense marriage. Still, quitting feels like death or divorce. And before you do it, it's like standing at the edge of a cliff. You're letting go of what you have, what you've built, a professional life that answers the question, who am I? It is a professional death with a rebirth that is uncertain. You are looking out over a precipice, unsure whether what awaits will bring net pleasure or pain, or most likely, both. But you know what you have to do. Don't think, dude. Just jump. Conclusion. 7 words to remember. This book started on an airplane at night. I asked you to eavesdrop with me on an elderly man of great worldly accomplishment as he confessed that he'd just as soon be dead. His abilities had declined. Life had become a source of frustration and dissatisfaction. No one cared about him like they used to, it seemed, if they ever really did care about him in the first place. That experience rattled me so much that I privately started a research agenda to see if the man's fate was inevitably mine as well, or rather, if there was something I could do to avoid it. I wound up making major changes in my life. I resigned from my job and jumped into a liminal state, moved to work that focused on my crystallized intelligence, and chipped away at my attachments. I developed my friendships and family relationships and deepened my spiritual life. I vowed not to objectify myself and to be defenseless about my weaknesses so I could truly learn my new vocation and dedicate it to lifting up others. None of these things came easily or even naturally. They went against my striverly urges. And this leads me to underscore once again the truth that nature is not destiny, and sometimes we must fight our natural instincts if we want to be happy. This is hard for some people to believe, I know. Our worldly urges for money, power, pleasure, and prestige come from our ancient limbic brains. We also instinctively want to be happy and satisfied. We then make an erroneous connection. Since I have these urges, following them must make me happy. But that is Mother Nature's cruel hoax. She doesn't really care either way whether you are unhappy. If you conflate intergenerational survival with well-being, that's your problem, not hers. And matters are hardly helped by Mother Nature's useful idiots in society who propagate a popular piece of life-ruining advice. If it feels good, do it. Unless you share existential goals with protozoa, this is flat-out wrong. To go from strength to strength requires learning a new set of life skills. We need to adopt a new formula, which I have laid out in detail in this book, chapter by chapter. But of course, you're unlikely to memorize the last 60,000 words. So let me summarize the whole book in 7, a formula that encapsulates all the lessons I have learned and now strive to live. Use things, love people, worship the divine. Don't misunderstand what I'm saying here. I'm not exhorting you to hate and reject the world, to live like a hermit in a Himalayan cave. There's nothing bad or shameful about the world's material abundance, and we are right to enjoy it. Material abundance is what gives us our daily bread and pulls our sisters and brothers out of poverty. It reflects the blessings of our creativity and work and can provide comfort and enjoyment to humdrum days. The problem is not the noun things, but the verb to love. Things are to use, not to love. If you remember only one lesson from this book, it should be that love is at the epicenter of our happiness. Around the year 400, the great Saint Augustine summarized this lesson as the secret to a good life. Love, and do what you will. But love is reserved for people, not things. To misplace your love is to invite frustration and futility, to get on the hedonic treadmill and set it to ultra fast. Take love up one level and we have worship. The writer David Foster Wallace once said astutely, "There is no such thing as not worshiping. Everybody worships. The only choice we get is what to worship." If you love things, you will strive to objectify yourself in terms of money, power, pleasure, and prestige, idols all. You will worship yourself, or at least a two-dimensional cutout of yourself. Once again, this is what the world assures will bring happiness. But the world lies. Idols will not make you happy, and thus you must not worship yourself. Take to heart the commands of Moses in the book of Deuteronomy when it comes to idols. Thus shall you deal with them. You shall break down their altars and dash in pieces their pillars and chop down their asherim and burn their carved images with fire. This book showed you how, but you have to decide to do it. The man on the plane today. Before I finish, it occurs to me that you might be wondering, whatever happened to the man on the plane? He's still pretty famous, popping up on the news from time to time, although less each year. He's very old. Early on, when I saw a news story about him, I would feel a flash of something like pity, but which I now realize was really only a refracted sense of terror about my own future. Poor guy really meant, I'm screwed. But as my grasp of the right formula and the lessons in this book has deepened, my fear has disappeared. I was thinking, I should really put him in the acknowledgement section of this book. My feeling toward him is one of gratitude for what he taught me, albeit inadvertently. He set me on a path that has changed my life. First, I did the research to expose the sources of misery among so many people who are life's winners, misery for which I was surely destined. Second, he set in motion a series of life changes that I never would have made otherwise. Third, I was able to enumerate the secrets to making these changes and share them with you. In truth, the man on the plane is who I have to thank for allowing me to be happy and fulfilled for the rest of my life, whether that is 2 years or 40. I will go to my grave without revealing his identity. However, he will be in my thoughts every day. My hope is that before his time comes, he will find peace and joy. And I hope you will too. May you go from strength to strength. This is Arthur C. Brooks. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of From Strength to Strength, Finding Success, Happiness, and Deep Purpose in the Second Half of Life. This program was directed by Sean Renette. Executive producer, Lauren Klein. edited by Josh Arakelian. Text copyright 2022 by Arthur Brooks. Production copyright 2022, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.